A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on November 17, 2002, in the series Once Upon a Time, entitled Abraham, One God, Three Names. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3, and 21, verses 8 through 21. And Romans 9, verses 1 through 8, and 11, verses 25 through 36. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, I've got about 90 minutes of stuff to cram in the next 15. I think I'll just put it in pieces and come back to it next week. It's serendipitous that one sets a course of preaching, and then as one comes to the particular subjects, there appears a bestseller which has gone there before. You perhaps have read a major article in Time magazine some time ago about the book by Bruce Feiler, Abraham. As he researches Abraham in his own personal pilgrimage as a Jewish man, trying to understand the heart of the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And he goes back to Israel, to Palestine, and he interviews leaders of the three respective faiths, and he visits the shrines and the sacred places. And a brilliant writer that he is, gives us a marvelous portrayal of those three historic traditions who continue to encounter one another so tragically in the Holy Land, even as we speak. Hebron, the city south of Jerusalem, wherein is the shrine of Abraham. The story in Genesis has it that toward the end of his life, when Sarah died, Abraham purchased a piece of ground in which to bury Sarah. And he too is buried there. And there is a shrine which has been an Islamic a Muslim mosque, but also a Jewish synagogue or place of worship. And in 1967, when the Jews in that war captured the territory of which Hebron is a part, that shrine was opened again for Jewish worshipers. And subsequent to that, both Jews and Muslims went to respective areas in that shrine for their prayers. You may remember in 1994 that an American-born Jew who was one of the settlers, a Dr. Baruch Goldstein, went into the mosque and gunned down 29 Muslims as they were at prayer. And this past Friday, Palestinian gunmen killed 12 Jews at Hebron as they were on their way to prayer. And as we speak, Israeli troops have moved again into the Palestinian area of Hebron to occupy it and to deal with this ongoing anguish. And so what we are talking about this morning, three face, one God, all of which three face find their rootage in Abraham. We are talking about an ancient story that is as present as tomorrow morning's headlines. And if we needed any impetus to wrestle with the issue of the relationship between the great religious traditions, in this case, the three Western traditions, the people of the book, the people who understand God's action in history. If we needed any impetus to do that, the ongoing anguish that is occurring daily should drive all religious people to think again about the nature of their particular tradition and the nature of the whole religious experience itself. The story of Abraham is familiar. It is a Jewish story. It comes in the Hebrew scriptures. And Abraham grows up in a polytheistic environment. We can call it pagan. It was ancient. It was simply the kind of religious experience in that Tigris-Euphrates area, Ur of the Chaldees, where he was born. And what happens? How do we know? Somehow or other, Abraham's family moves out of there to the north and to the west, and then Abraham hears a call. We don't know if Abraham was a historical figure or not. He certainly is a mythical figure, lost in the fog of ancient history before history was recorded. He comes down to us in terms of story. But at least the things that we see about that patriarchal history in the scriptures are reflective of other archaeological discoveries. And so at least Abraham is a believable, a viable figure living somewhere between 2100 and 1500 before the Common Era. But the story in Genesis tells us of a person who hears a call from God, simply to pick up and to go where he knew not, but to go trusting that God would guide and lead. Abraham is considered to be that first monotheist, the first one, although he didn't really deny the existence of other gods either, but at least there was that beginning of the sense that there was one God, that God, if God was God, God must be one. And the story already in its beginning has in its universal dimension the possibility of exclusivism, because we're talking now about the true God. Okay? Well, the story is familiar. He hears this call. He goes off with Sarah, his wife. She is barren. We are told that in Genesis 11:30. Sarah is barren, because what this story is about is God beginning again. God who began in creation with Adam and Eve, God who began again with Noah to no avail after the flood. God will begin again with one couple. to whom he says, you will have seed like the stars of the heaven and the sand of the seashore. And he begins with a barren womb, because this will be a new creation. And the story goes on. Years pass. The promise is there, but Abraham despairs. And Sarah, she doesn't think there's a possibility in the world. And then you know the story. She says to Abraham, take my handmaid Hagar. And Hagar, the slave girl, becomes pregnant. And Ishmael is born. And Abraham is satisfied with Ishmael, but God says, in the story, God says, no, not Ishmael. Sarah will bear a son. And eventually she does. It's Isaac. And then you have that agonizing scene of Sarah seeing Ishmael play with his little brother Isaac, and seeing in Ishmael a threat to her son Isaac, saying to Abraham, cast the slave woman out with her child. And they're sent out into the desert to die. Terrible story. One thing about the Jewish scriptures, they're honest with the awful human situation. But God intervenes and says to Hagar, don't abandon the child. And she finds a well. God provides. And Ishmael becomes the father of this great nation, the Arab nations. And now we have this setup of the blessing of the promise going through Isaac to Jacob, to Israel. And we have the story in the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures. So Abraham is the patriarchal head, the fountainhead, from whom comes this line that also has other lines that don't seem to matter or count. So that immediately we're set up for a future conflict situation. Because the exclusivism of that covenant promise of the true God will come to greater and greater expression. So the Jews have their story, and Abraham is their father, and their father through the line of Isaac. Well, eventually, Jesus comes along, and a Jew named Paul sees in Jesus the Messiah, the Christ, the promised one. But now, how is this Jew who sees Jesus as the Messiah to make sense of that in terms of his Jewishness? And what about the fact that the Jewish people at large are not following Jesus? The Jewish movement was a viable movement. It was possible at that time that Judaism could have become this universalizing faith that reached out to the Gentiles. But it did not. The Pharisaic rabbinical leaders of the ongoing Jewish community regrouped, and they became the dominant and ongoing Jewish community, so that today we still have a Jewish community. It was possible 2,000 years ago that there might not have been a Jewish community, right? Because Paul, a powerful Jewish spokesman, if he had carried the day, there would no longer have been a particular Israel. Follow me? But Paul had to understand his own experience of Jesus in terms of his Jewishness. And so what does he do? He goes back and he rewrites the story of Abraham. And he says to his Jewish detractors, look, you're all hung up with the Mosaic law and a kind of legalistic community. But actually, you stem from Abraham. And Abraham preceded the law. Abraham was before the covenant, the Mosaic covenant. This is too complicated to make it very clear to you. Just hear me say this, that what Paul does is he appropriates Abraham in a sense which is other than the way the Jews themselves understood their people. Paul used Abraham, the father of the Jews, against his Jewish brothers and sisters. He rewrote the story. He rewrote it powerfully, persuasively, because Paul really wanted to say to his Jewish brothers and sisters, look, this one has come now to break the bonds of our particularity. This one has come now for the whole world. Paul had a universal vision. It was glorious. It was great. He brought the Jewish God to the world. Wonderful. Except the ongoing Jewish community didn't think it was so wonderful. So they had their story of their Abraham in Genesis. That was their story. It was their story. Paul took their story, rewrote the story, put a different slant on it, a nuance. Good. Then, 600 years later, a desert nomad named Muhammad had a vision. He had a vision of the one true God, the God of Abraham. And he began to share his visions with the Jewish community in Medina when they rejected him. They booted him. Well, I would too if some nut walked in off the street and tried to tell us he just had a vision of God on Savage Street. Come on. But Muhammad was no slouch. He was a very capable, able man with an ongoing sense of this revelation which he wrote down. He too needed roots. And he went back to Abraham too. And he went back to Abraham legitimately because through Ishmael, Abraham was his father. And now the story is rewritten again. It's crafted differently. And now you've got three religions, each with a story that relates it back to one person. But the stories are all different. Walter Brueggemann, and I gave you an insert, you can read it this afternoon, a little quote from Filer's book, Abraham. And there you'll find a quote from Walter Brueggemann. I have met Walter Brueggemann. He is probably as fine an Old Testament scholar as we have in the country today. He's written some excellent stuff. He's got a beautiful sense. He loves the Hebrew Scriptures. And in the quote, which I won't take time to read now, he said, it is perfectly legitimate for the Jews to write their story and trace it back to Abraham. And it's perfectly legitimate for the Christians and telling their story to bring it back to Abraham. And it's perfectly legitimate for the Muslim people to write their story and bring it back to Abraham. What is not legitimate is for any one of the three to claim that their story is the story. And then he uses a nice phrase. He said, we have to understand these stories as interpretive movements. These are stories that are told by people who are trying to understand who in the world they are, who in the world God is, and what all of this is about, and they're telling stories in order to make some sense, in order to relate themselves back, to have some rootage and some understanding of why they are like they are. Religious stories are interpretive movements. People tell these stories in order to gain a sense of identity, in order to know what this fragile and fascinating and terrifying human existence is all about. That's really what religious stories are about. They're not true or false. They're stories. They're parables. They're interpretive movements. And I can't enter into everybody's story, but I have a story. And that story resonates with my experience, and therefore, I'm committed to that story and to the community of that story. But as Brueggemann says, I don't have to die for that story. And I don't have to claim it's the only story. Another person who's been a teacher of mine over the last years is Rabbi David Hartman. And in his Jewish treatment of the scripture, I've learned so much. And David Hartman says, you know, referring now to that anguishing story of Hagar and Sarah, Isaac and Ishmael, he said, you know what? We Jews wrote that story. We have to rethink and go back and change the story. And out of my background, I said, oh my God, you can't do that, David. That's the Bible. Well, what is the Bible? The Bible's a human storybook, religious storybook. It's a human interpretive movement. And then David Hartman goes on to say, in Judaism, the oral tradition trumps the written tradition. You see, Judaism existed for 1,000 years before its stories were written down. It wasn't until they were taken into exile in Babylon that the scribes actually began to write down the stories. And Ezra the scribe came back to Jerusalem at the time of the building of the Second Temple, and they became a people of the book, dotting the I and crossing the T. But Judaism never lost the right of the oral tradition to trump the written truth. They never got stuck on the text. I was trained to be stuck on the text as a Christian. And my, as Christian, stuck on the text isn't half bad compared to a Muslim, to Islamic adherence to the letter of the text. And the more I survey the whole thing, the more I see the wisdom of a David Hartman who says, the text illuminates things for me, but finally, for me, it's the lived history of my people. It's the living tradition. I mean, where has life moved? Where has history gone? More and more and more, I recognize more and more and more that the religious problem in our world today is that we are stuck on texts. We would be better off if somehow or other we could burn all of the Torahs and all of the Bibles and all of the Qurans of the world and then look at each other as human beings and start over. Of course, that's ridiculous. That'll never happen, of course. And it shouldn't happen. But we should come to see the diabolical nature of the text when it is absolutized. which disables us from looking into each other's eyes and meeting heart to heart. We need to get beyond the text to the real situation and think again and lead with our hearts as human beings. It can happen. It happened to Bruce Feiler. It's happened to David Hartman. It's happened to Walter Brueggemann. It's happened to me. It is possible to get over the exclusivity and the absolutisms of a textual religion. Not throwing it out, but simply receiving it as an interpretive moment that enables me to know who I am and see my brothers and sisters in other communities doing exactly the same thing. Then the world would not be so dangerous, in spite of the fact that one God has three names.